We're back again, Siege fans, with another dose of doom. This time, Brian, Jeff, and I will be looking at environmental doom in fiction and current events. Unlike comet doom or nuke doom or even the less common bio doom, enviro doom is seriously underrepresented in books and movies. Given the obsession that one political party has with climate being an existential crisis, one that will imperil hundreds of millions of people and cause massive upheaval. In fact, a few years ago, a very vocal member of that party was predicting that humanity had only 12 years left to avert a horrible and inescapable doom. As dire and terrible as the politicians' predictions have been, I find it rather odd that Hollywood hasn't jumped on the enviro-doom bandwagon. That's kind of uncharacteristic of the entertainment industry, if you think about our other doom chats. Back then, a mere misquote of an astronomer launched a bunch of comet doom novels and movies. Dropping of an atomic bomb spawned decades of nuke doom stories. A few epidemics in the 80s and 90s gave rise to half a dozen bio-doom stories. So, what's up with enviro-doom? Where are the blockbuster disaster films about mankind triggering the collapse of our environment, creating hell on Earth, with hundreds of millions of casualties, all because we insisted on eating beef and driving our gasoline engine vehicles? That should have been a slam dunk, if you think about it. I mean, Al Gore had his famous hockey stick chart back in 2006 that showed the Earth getting so hot so fast that we should all be drowning or roasting. Or both, maybe, by now. Quick doom scenarios are good for action scenes. Surely the hockey stick was quick enough for Hollywood. And politicians do love to foment fear, for which, of course, their billion-dollar programs are the only solution. Hollywood is super happy to visualize our fears. Think about the movie Jaws or Arachnophobia. And yet, where are all the enviro-doom movies? There should be dozens of them. We had to scour movie lists and archives to find any. There are a few movies that are kind of environmental stories, but none of them were really the global warming doom that the young activists march on Washington for with signs that say the Earth is burning. Some films are kinda sorta environmental, but they're still not Al Gore's global warming, and certainly nothing a prepper could use as inspiration to prep. For instance, there was M. Night Shyamalan's movie, The Happening, that was about plants of the world somehow working together to create spores that made people commit suicide, thereby freeing all those plants of Earth from those nasty humans. Or from the 1970s, the sci-fi movie Silent Running with Bruce Dern, where the Earth became so polluted that people had to put a bunch of trees and plants and animals out in spaceships to save them from those evil, polluting humans. Nasty humans. That's kind of a common denominator. So, we searched for movies in which people had to cope with a rapidly changing environment to see if there were any tips that a prepper might learn from for dealing with this existential threat that's supposed to doom us in 7 years now, if AOC is correct. So, Brian, did you find any enviro-doom movies?
I did. It's an old one, too, 1973. People probably remember this. It's called Soylent Green with Charlton Heston.
So I saw that a long time ago. Could you give us a quick synopsis, just in case there's somebody who wasn't around in the 70s?
Yeah. Actually, I believe it was filmed in 1973, but the plot was for 2022, so we've already passed this. We had overpopulation, global warming, pollution caused by ecocide, which is a cool name, leading to severe shortages of food and water and housing and bringing the whole world, or at least our country, to a collapse. And people just lived in squander. They didn't have the resources that we have now. Every average person was desperately poor, relying on the government to feed them. And I would say house them, but it appeared that a lot of people slept in public spaces. And in this particular movie here, they seem to live on staircases and stuff like that. And the government would feed them rations of Soylent, which is made from plankton. And they had, I believe it was Soylent Yellow and Soylent Red. And then eventually Soylent Green was introduced. And that turned into a surprise ingredient, which is kind of what leads to the ending plot of the movie. I don't know if you want me to spoil that or not. I'm sure 1973, most people have probably seen this or are aware of the plot.
Yeah, I think the basic idea for why they called it Soylent Green was it was supposed to be made out of plankton. I say supposed to be because I think the hero or the main character ends up uncovering, what was it, articles or scientific something or other that said the oceans are too polluted. They can't be making that much plankton. So then he started looking for, well, then what are they making Soylent Green out of if it isn't plankton? And of course, he didn't like the answer when he went to the factory and saw how they make it. Sort of worse than making a sausage.
That's a nasty sausage. Yeah, he was a New York Police Department detective, Robert Thorne, and together with his, I guess, co-worker and friend that he lived with, Saul, who had an interesting exit on the movie as well with a government-assisted suicide. But they had came to the conclusion, like you said, with a couple of books, manuscripts from the past that were basically not supposed to be public. And Thorne, the detective, he had jumped onto trash trucks and went to the plant and discovered that Soylent Green was actually made of people, dead people. That's nice and tasty, but it was a decent movie. I think it was kind of like a global warming and overpopulation warning from Hollywood, you know, how they like to overreact and stuff. But at the time in the 70s, we were looking at global warming and overpopulation. Now it appears that we're not having enough babies, so I guess they can't make up their mind.
Well, that's not unusual. Did you find any prepper tips, or was there a prepper angle in looking at it? You thought, I should keep that in mind, other than don't let people eat you.
Yeah, I think that all of our preps that we do would come in handy for that. Of course, you'd have to keep it well hidden in a totalitarian government like that, like we ended up turning into. As a detective, he had a little bit more access, so he kind of let some of that get to his head with the concubines, which they called furniture. I thought that was a little bit out of place for a movie, at least for today's standards.
Well, that was before Me Too.
But, I mean, depending on your status in your relationship with the government, you could do real well in those, even those times. So either you prep, or you move on up the ladder of the government or the well-connected and wealthy, because there were super rich people at the time, too.
So the sort of scenario, I guess, for the common people in that movie was that they were totally dependent on the government for their food and everything. So that struck me as something to kind of keep in mind. To make yourself completely dependent on the government means you kind of got to eat and sleep whatever they give you. You got no options.
Yeah, trying to live a little bit more self-reliant lifestyle is probably beneficial in the times like that. You know, maybe not live in New York City. That's probably a bad idea when things are getting that bad.
That was on my list anyway, is to not live in New York City. Sorry, yeah, Frank.
Avoid the populated areas and do your due diligence as far as prepping and self-reliance, maybe a little homesteading. Of course, it didn't really go into that, but you'd have to maintain a low profile or something, because it appeared through the scenario with, or the plot with that particular movie, it was pretty totalitarian-ish.
Yeah, one thing I got from that is, from the prepper standpoint, is don't be the first one to run to the government trough, because you might end up in it.
Yeah.
Literally, yeah.
Let that be a warning to you. So, Jeff, you had something newer than the 1970s?
I did. 2004, The Day After Tomorrow, starring Dennis Quaid. It was an actual global warming event that triggers an ice age, because the ice caps actually melted and caused the desalinization of the North Atlantic Current. So we actually had some sciencey stuff in that one that gave us the plausibility of New York being 50 foot underwater, and then it froze with very large vessels somehow in the middle of downtown, but couldn't get down a narrow street, but they jumped over the buildings.
So if it was global warming, how did you end up with frozen New York City? That seems kind of oxy.
you know, they don't put those together. They just blame everything on global warming and give us the event.
Oh, well, that's fairly current. So you give us a quick synopsis about what happened in there?
Well, yeah, basically the ice sheets melting caused tsunamis, tornadoes in Hollywood, you know, flooding all over the planet and disrupting the environment. What would normally be summer, I guess, in the north, it was constant ice and everybody ends up moving to the equator. And all of a sudden, Mexico had to deal with a bunch of illegal immigration.
Well, that's only fair. And the Dennis Quaid character, I seem to remember he was on a quest of some kind.
As we discussed in one of our earlier Doom sessions, the main character is always somebody's ex-husband who happens to be the Earth-saving scientist. But a group of kids end up in public library downtown New York City. They survive by what little bit of food they can get out of the vending machines and a cargo ship or whatever that ends up. And the crazy wolves that somehow survived on the ship and burning a lot of books in the public library, including the tax code.
I suppose that was supposed to elicit cheers from the audience.
Correct.
So I don't remember how that movie ended. I don't know if I dozed off or what, but was the Earth saved or did the CGI wolves eat everybody?
No. That can't happen. There was a group of survivors. And as the president addresses the world from Mexico, there's quite a few survivors that were standing on top of buildings, or they climbed to the top of buildings after the storm had surpassed. And we knew it was passed because the people in the space station told us it did. They said the Earth had never looked clearer.
Okay.
So you can survive if you have the preps, I guess, or like a lot of other movies, fate.
You just luck out?
Yes, sometimes, yeah.
Now, was that also kind of a massive bug out movie that all the people that were going to survive needed to pack up and flee to Mexico, outrun the glaciers?
You know, I think the people that had the opportunity, they led you to believe that, yes, the southern border was flooded with people bugging out. However, the people north of their imaginary line, it happened so quick that there really wasn't the opportunity to react.
So then there's not a whole lot of prepping unless you got a lot of propane and heaters, I suppose. But so did you get any? Yeah, well, you have to have food. Were there any other sort of prepper lessons that came out of that movie? I mean, it was raw entertainment. It wasn't intending to be an instructional film, but still, did you come away as a prepper thinking, oh, okay, maybe I do need a few more canisters of propane?
Well, yeah, you always want to have your get home or your bug out bag ready. But this also kind of put a crimp in that you had to be flexible, because if your current bug out location would have been to go north to a cabin, that's not going to work out so well. So you got to be ready, and a very big importance on having some medications, especially antibiotics.
I don't remember that part in the movie.
When the girl got her leg cut running through the flooded taxis. And then she didn't tell anybody and they discovered it because her fever had basically caused her to pass out. That's what they went on the ship for originally.
Oh, was to get the antibiotics?
Correct.
Boy, I must have dozed off twice. I don't remember that either. Well, the movie that I picked out, I was searching for a global warming movie that actually had global warming as opposed to a new ice age. And I did kind of find one in a 1961 British film called The Day the Earth Caught Fire. That sounds like global warming. A quick synopsis of that was that you find out that the Americans and the Soviets both happened to have conducted some atmospheric nuclear tests at the same time. And that caused the Earth's climate to change, torrential rains and floods in some spots, searing heat and drought in others. England, where the movie is set in London, is having a record heat wave and drought. You get some mural views of the Thames River as just dried up mud, and water becomes scarce, and eventually the government controls it. Most of the Brits suffered through the water rationing, standing in lines to get their gallon of water with stiff upper lips. The people who could afford to fled the city for the country. I don't know why it would be better there, but that's where they were going. Later into the movie, we find out that the reason that the heat wave came after the nukes was that the nukes pushed the Earth out of its orbit, and it's moving closer to the sun. So Earth and humanity are doomed. Their only hope is for another well-timed combined nuclear explosion in Siberia someplace to hopefully push the Earth back into its proper orbit. And the original British version of the movie hinted that it failed, that mankind was doomed. The world would be on fire. The American release of the same movie hinted that the counter-nukes worked and that mankind was saved. I thought that was interesting, two different spins. This wasn't really a Greta-style global warming, though. Even though mankind did cause it, it was nukes, not cow gas or carbon dioxide, that caused it. But that was as close as I could get. But putting aside the actual cause, the effect was still global warming, and pretty radical global warming. The people of London tried to cope with the oppressive heat and the water shortages. That sounded sort of like something you might have to do. Many people hoarded the precious stashes of water that they had in their homes, but then those became the target of looters who were looking for water. And there was one odd scene that had some crazed rioters who were like delirious from the heat or something, and they were going through the streets dousing each other with buckets of water and some sort of wanton orgy of waste and wetness. It was kind of like a last hurrah of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we get burned up. So that was kind of weird. One of the interesting things that the movie The Day the Earth Caught Fire was how the editor and director used existing footage of various natural disasters, floods, forest fires, structure fires, typhoons, etc., to illustrate how the climate had changed in that scenario of the movie. I thought it was fascinating that shortly after that, I watched a supposed documentary called Climate Refugees that was supposed to visualize for us what a terrible, no good, very bad climate that Al Gore and Greta have promised us and what it would look like. They did the exact same thing. They took existing footage of floods and mudslides and typhoons and tornadoes and spliced all that together with a sort of, this is the terrible fate that awaits you if you don't listen to Greta and sit up straight and eat your peas. It was all bad news. So I thought that was kind of interesting that it was the same directorial and editorial trick to make a bad climate to scare you with. So that was my movie. The prepper part I got out of that was store water. As well, you could end up with a drought. It was a few years ago here, we had quite a spell of dry in a summer, and the water tables were going down, and some people's wells were failing. Mine didn't. Some cities were doing water rationing. You were only supposed to water your lawn once a week or something, but that was on city water. And you weren't supposed to wash your car. I know, terrible fate. That at least hinted at you could have a situation where water might not be as plentiful as it is now. So A, don't waste it, but B, have some on hand. So I thought that was kind of a thing to pull away. That and don't mess around with nuclear tests because you might bump the Earth out of its orbit. Not that I had a big opportunity to do that or not do that. So Brian, I think you said you had a different something else. Was it a book? It wasn't a movie.
Yeah, it's a 4-book series by Bobby Acart called the Yellowstone series. And I listened to it on Audible, all 4 books, and it was pretty interesting. A little excessive as far as resources available to the characters, but nonetheless, it was about the Yellowstone volcano finally giving us that big super volcano eruption that people have feared for generations. It was more of like human caused rather than, you know, the natural eruption. So we had like a private-public partnership type of thing where an energy company devises a plan. And this was an actual proposal years ago, I believe, I was reading when I was doing some of the research. They wanted to inject water into the volcano arteries and cool it down and then take that steam or the emissions from that cooling and convert that into energy. So they get the benefit of cooling down the supervolcano and in their logic, reducing the chances of eruption while getting free energy out of it. Well, what they did is they went too deep or something and actually caused this premature eruption of the supervolcano that basically killed hundreds of millions of people and destroyed in life on planet, you know, in a large portion, you know, animals, plants, people, everything. It was pretty interesting.
Well, how do you have a book two after you've destroyed everything?
All four books took the key major characters, which was a volcanologist. Of course, like Jeff said, there's always somebody that you know in the stories that's a professional. And then a Yellowstone cop, and it took them down south. So during the eruption, they get on a helicopter that crashes, and then they move on into California, where this guy had a family home because his family was very wealthy. And turns out that even in Northern California, they were going to get, I don't recall if it was 1 foot or 3 foot of ash, but either way, you can't grow crops. Everything dies, including animals and everything. So they had to continue moving south. And then they went further south in California. That was a mistake because it was a more dangerous area in the way the people were acting, you know, murder and mayhem and all that. They ended up getting on a boat, trying to go to Mexico. Apparently, we have an agreement with Mexico and other nations. So if we have a natural disaster like Yellowstone, or vice versa, we accept the refugees or they accept our refugees. Of course, they reneged on that and closed the border and wouldn't let Americans in and demanded more money and stuff. And other countries followed suit. And I believe it was Australia that actually was the nice guys and let American refugees in. But with Yellowstone, you'd want to be in the southern hemisphere to be able to survive. And they found an island, which is just amazing that they found an island that was suitable for them to live out the next several years through the dark winters and all that, that was going to follow the disaster of a super volcano. I do want to mention that the second place that they went in California, one of the family homes that this guy owned, had a community neighborhood. What do you call those? HMOs?
Is that HOAs. Right?
HOA. Oh, yeah, HOAs. HMO is a health thing. Well, you could have that too, I guess. You want to be healthy.
Yeah, they had an HOA type of thing that got really extreme. You had to be approved to come in and you had to give up all your food. So a lot of preppers worry about this type of thing. So everybody has to like donate their food and their weapons and everything to the group, and then it's distributed evenly, supposedly, except for the people that are running the things and they're robbing everyone blind, and they had to escape that community. It had gotten to the point to where somebody got killed and everything. I don't want to give the whole story away because it's worth reading.
So socialism still doesn't work?
Not in that case it didn't. Nope. Probably a bad time to start trying to do something like that after the end of the world.
So was this series from the What Can I Do as a Prepper perspective a little bit like Patriots, that it pays to be really rich?
It was a lot like Patriots as far as it's very unrealistic as far as the resources they have available. Although there were some struggles, but they had access to unlimited cash, even gold bars, which is amazing, every kind of weapon you could imagine, unlimited ammunition. And then they just kind of fell into all of this. So I guess as an author I'm not a professional writer, but I guess as an author, it's easier to come up with scenarios where all the resources and cash and everything kind of falls into your lap so you can solve some problems and move on with the storyline. But in real life, I think it's probably better to do all the things that we've been talking about incredibly in all these doom stories is our regular preps, our food, our water, our resources, our supplies, cash type of thing.
So if you don't happen to be incredibly independently wealthy, prep?
Prep, yep. Prep and prepare. Be as self-reliant as possible and get ready to defend yourself and what you have.
There you go. So those were the fictional things that we had, at least for this particular episode. But of course, the whole climate crisis is a very much current events kind of a thing that we're all surrounded with. And like AOC said, we only had 12 years, but that was 5 years ago. So we have even less time. What's your guys' reaction been to the hurry up and give me millions of dollars? Well, sorry, billions, billions and trillions of dollars. I'm dating myself by saying millions like it's a lot. What's your guys' take on the climate crisis hype? Brian?
I think there's probably some truth to climate change. How much of that is our cause? You know, it's up for debate. We do cause some things. I mean, there's no denying that there's plastic in the ocean and all this type of stuff. As far as throwing hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars at it, you know, by people that we cannot trust with a dime that they've stolen from us, without getting into like politics or opinion, I think it's just lining the pockets of the rich and wealthy and well-connected and such. So very little of it you can take on face value. Are they trying to fight a war, or are they trying to get rich? Are they trying to fix the environment, or are they trying to get more power and money? The common sense answer to me is just don't throw your trash on the ground and try to protect what you have and take care of your communities and your land and respect people and property and nature. Hopefully teach your kids that. As far as what, you know, the government or anybody else trying to say you need to pay more for this because you guys did this when we didn't do any of it. It's actually the same people that are causing all these problems are the ones demanding payment for it. So I say we just move on with life and don't worry about it.
Well, good luck with that. So, Jeff, you got any 2 cents? You always have 2 cents.
Down to a penny because of inflation, but we're going to keep politics out of it. So
we are.
Kind of like Brian, you know, there's always things we can do better. Getting the litter cleaned up and not wasting water just because it's there, you know, letting your garden hose run down the driveway is kind of dumb. But at the same time, yeah, we're getting played. I truly believe that a lot of the data is being manipulated to continue the studies of these government-funded narratives. I don't think the predictions have proved themselves over the years.
Yeah, so far, not so much.
Exactly. A lot of fear. The climate industry is a pretty well-managed business model.
Yeah, I had mentioned that pseudo-documentary thing that I saw called Climate Refugees when you were talking about failed predictions. One of the talking head experts that they had in their movie was a guy named Paul Ehrlich, who wrote the book Population Bomb in 1968. And there he was predicting that the world would run out of food in the mid-1970s, which, Brian, is also part of where Soylent Green came from for a premise, was we're going to run out of food, so what are we going to eat then? But, of course, the mid-70s came, and there wasn't a massive famine. In fact, everybody was kind of doing pretty good until the Carter years, but never mind, because we're keeping politics out of it. That he then, Ehrlich, revised his book to say that, oh, no, it's going to be in the mid-80s. That's when the famine is going to hit and the world will be overpopulated. And as you might expect, the mid-80s came and, you know, there wasn't a famine. So then he said it was the mid-90s. And so he still keeps predicting that famine is just a few years away if we don't somehow spend trillions of dollars. So I almost turned off that film when I saw they had Paul Ehrlich as one of their experts on how bad things are going to be, because I thought, you've been wrong for 50 years. Why are you the guy that I should be listening to? So anyway, that's a little detail on that climate refugees and being wrong. I hadn't checked the other predictors of doom, but I kind of wonder how often they're wrong as well. I just didn't happen to know about them. And then, of course, like you said, Jeff, the power play part of it, that politicians are using fear a lot to try and push us into signing up for something or at least letting them take money out of our pockets. So it does tend to be a bit of a power play on the climate changing in general. I guess from a personal standpoint, I can kind of see where from, I don't know, maybe the mid-70s, late-70s until now, things have been getting just a little bit warmer and a little bit warmer. Because I remember when I first moved to New Hampshire, that winters would pretty typically have 3.5 feet of snow. I used to go snowshoeing because you didn't want to sink up to your waist. But lately, there hasn't been a whole lot of snow. And quite a few years ago, the mice got at the leather webbing of my snowshoes, and I thought, well, I'm going to have to replace that leather. But since there hasn't been that much snow, I kind of have never gotten around to it because I haven't needed snowshoes. So I thought, all right, the climate could be getting gradually warmer, but I don't know that it has anything to do with cow gas or carbon dioxide. In fact, there was a different movie I sent you guys a link to called The Climate Crisis, The Cold Truth. Did either of you guys watch that one? I'm sure you watch every movie that I send you a link to.
I have it on my to-do list. I'm sorry.
That means you did not do your homework. You were a bad student.
Yes, sir.
Now, is that the same one that we were talking about that yeah. I watched part of, the yeah. Climate the Movie?
Yeah.
Okay, okay. Yeah, it's very eye-opening, and it's got a very long list of accomplished government people from within that circle that are speaking out against it and explaining how the government narrative doesn't really match the actualities of the world.
Yeah, there was one guy that, now they were all kind of on the older side, so maybe that's why they were less in fear of their careers, because they were already sort of well established. But the one guy was talking about how the climate scaremongers talk about the consensus of scientists. And he said, well, these are all people who are getting government funding to say it's the climate. So what do you expect them to say? Because that's where their money is coming from. But he was also saying that anybody that says the science is settled is not a scientist, because the science can never be settled. So he said that's one of the trigger words that tells you that it's not, it doesn't have anything to do with science. So I thought that one was interesting. And he was, it was a different guy who was talking about the federal funding was almost like the source of the problem rather than cow gas as the source of the problem, is that all these government-funded studies really insist that you approve of the global warming scenario, that your research better support that or you're not going to get any funding. So there's a whole lot of junior scientists and would-be PhD people who are really counting on that government money to either be their income or get them into a career. So it's not too big of a surprise that they're saying what the government wants to hear. Not because it's necessarily true, but you know, what was that other guy was talking about? He was saying that even if your study had nothing to do with the climate, that if you could insert a few words that had something, some passing reference to climate change, that it would help you get funding. I'm just kind of making it up, but if you were talking about the mating habits of the wild gerbil or something, it had nothing to do with climate, but if you could put in there something about affected by climate change, that you were more assured of getting funding. So I thought, well, there's kind of a problem, is if you keep paying for this, I'm not too surprised you keep getting a lot of it.
Yeah, one of the points that was made on that was that they're still using the same Earth-based temperature sensors from whenever they started doing this. And all those areas have turned into just concrete jungles, and the cities have developed around them, which are known to be heat maps. So they're using these fake numbers to say that the Earth is warming uncharacteristically, when it's really just a bunch of concrete around them getting.
Yeah, I remember that guy. I don't remember who he was, but he was talking about the urban heat island effect, that the sensors that used to be, well, what was it? They were citing, like, one of them was what's now Dulles Airport outside of Washington. It used to be pastures and farmland and whatever, and they had a temperature sensor out there. Well, the city grew up around there, and they had an airport grow up around there, so now the whole area is warmer than it used to be.
Right.
And their warming data is sort of a false reading. And there was that guy that was talking about his satellite measurements, that he was measuring things with a satellite, and it was an inconvenient truth, to borrow Gore's phrase, that the satellites weren't saying the Earth is warming anything like the heat island effect. But of course, the climate models all use that heat island data. So of course, the models are going to say, well, yeah, you guys should be on fire next Tuesday, because that's the data they're putting into it. And the data that runs against that just doesn't get published. In fact, what was the one guy was even saying, that they were getting hate mail and death threats because they weren't towing the line? I don't know if those were people who were afraid of losing their careers. So what's a prepper to do about climate change? If it is gradually, slowly changing, other than putting filters on your cows, I'm not too sure what you could do. Got any ideas? What about you as a prepper? What are you going to do about climate change?
Well, I think you have to understand really the whole aspect of producing your own food and the environment and what that would take in your area, if you would have to relocate, you know, if something were to happen and fate made you move. but information's free. Study and learn how to raise crops in different climates and that kind of thing.
Well, that was one of the things that struck me about the sort of usual mantra doom about the climate is warming and things won't be able to grow where they used to. And I thought, well, maybe that's not a bad thing if what's now the tundra of Canada starts becoming wheat fields because it's warmer. I thought, well, why is that a bad thing? If Texas can't grow corn and wheat anymore because it's too hot, although I don't think you can be too hot for corn, you know, if things are getting warmer, that just means other stuff grows there that didn't. So I'm thinking, well, I haven't been able, well, not going to grow a palm tree. I don't really care. But there are crops that need to be warmer weather crops than I had been able to grow before. But if we're going to be a couple of degrees warmer, maybe I can start to grow something different that used to grow further south. And maybe I can do it now. So that's, like you say, kind of a learn to grow stuff opportunity. What about you, Brian? What are you going to do about the climate? Huh? What are you going to do to make Greta stop yelling at me?
Yeah, I'm just going to ignore all the doomsayers as far as whatever the government says. And no matter whether you believe that environmental doom is man-made or natural or if it's true or false, everything falls into preparing for whatever comes our way, right? So we prep based on our location, situation, and likely circumstances, right? So likely events. So is it likely that New York is going to have, you know, 12 feet of snow on it in our lifetimes? Or is it likely that Yellowstone is going to erupt? Or is it more likely we're going to have a car accident or lose a job or anything like that? So all this is fun and interesting, and the storylines are cool to read and watch. But in real life, we just need to prepare for those likely scenarios that's going to disrupt our lives, right? So the things that we think based on where we're at and our situation and type of stuff like that, the most likely events, that's what to prep for, which most of them involve food and water and things like that, right? So there's certain things that you want to do if you live in a hurricane zone, right? You want to prepare to evacuate and have your resources and stuff. Or if you live on top of a volcano, it might not be the ideal place to live, just like New York. Maybe moving has to be part of your preps, your planning. But listening to the government is rarely a good idea, in my opinion.
The government angle is one of those things I kind of pulled out of a couple of those stories, was the climate would change or something would go awry or whatever, but the government would step in, and the government was actually more of the problem than the environment. Like in Soylent Green, everybody was kind of like the streets of San Francisco with Tent City and squalor and, well, other problems that they had. And they made themselves dependent on the government for food. So you were basically a slave. That was kind of a little less harsh in the Day the Earth Caught Fire movie, was the government took control of everybody's water. It became this mandatory thing that now that we've got a crisis, the government's going to step in and manage it all. I thought, well, we wouldn't have to necessarily have a full-blown climate crisis for the government to want to step in and manage everything. Therein lies the danger, is they're from the government and they're here to help. Prepping to have your own sources of supplies rather than counting on the government to be the source of your supply, which kind of gets back to that World Economic Forum motto about you'll own nothing and be happy. Well, the only reason you own nothing is because the government owned it all instead of you. So I'm not sure how happy you could end up really being. You might have to eat Soylent Green. And you wouldn't have any choice.
Says it's pretty tasty and nutritious.
That's just what it says on the box.
Yeah.
So any last thoughts on prepping for climate doom?
I would encourage anybody that's concerned about the climate to get educated, because there's probably very little you can do to change it.
Some things seem okay. I'm not crazy about the cold weather and the snow and ice and all that, but we had our share of it. It's not extreme amounts. That doesn't mean next year we're not going to get hit hard. So we prep for that too. I keep the salt handy and the equipment to clear our vehicles, and we have the cold weather gear in our vehicles and all the preps that we would want it when we're mobile and out away from the house and that type of thing. So regardless of what the weather's doing, it's going to do what it's going to do. And the world is resilient. So just like Yellowstone, or if Yellowstone did go off, you know, this, you know, to its capacity and destroy most of us or all of us, or, you know, nuclear war or a comet or a meteor or anything like that, Mother Earth's going to be okay. It's going to bounce back. It's very, you know, resilient. We're not, as we prep for it. So, yeah, it's not really worrying about nature. It's worrying about what nature's going to do to us. So we probably should, you know, be cautious on what we do to her, show some respect, because more problems can come from when we think that we're in control of things. Just respect Mother Nature.
Well, I guess that's the cautionary tale side of people having their schemes to inject a whole lot of aerosol reflective stuff into the upper atmosphere to reflect the sun's rays. Yeah, you might be careful what you wish for, because you might overachieve. But that's just mankind. Like you say, we tend to think we've got the answers until we fall down the stairs and then we realize it wasn't a good idea.
Yep. Or change the biological, what is it called, the code within the vegetables, so that the only thing that can survive the poison that they put on our food is that food itself. It's probably, you know, probably pushing the envelope with that type of stuff.
So grow your own.
Yeah, as long as they'll let you.
Yeah, there's that government intervention thing again. So any other last thoughts before we wrap it up?
No, I think we've covered a lot. I think it gives people things to think about, and just keep in mind that these stories are stories for our entertainment and not necessarily real life. Just like the news today. It's just for entertainment purposes only and propaganda. So, but like we said, we weren't going to get, you know, into politics. So I won't bring any of that up.
That's good. I'm glad you didn't bring that up. All right. Well, in the show notes, I'll put links to these various stories and movies and things so that people have some resources to go and check out, like that climate movie, The Cold Truth. And I might see if I can find that climate refugees film too, just for a little contrast. Okay, guys. Well, I thank you for your time once again. And for now, I'll just thank you and say goodbye.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
See ya.
EnviroDoom turned out to be a challenging quest, at least as far as Hollywood-style films go. What was a lot more common were documentary-style films, like The Climate Refugees. Those put on a facade of being documentaries, that is, they document something. But if you watch them carefully, you can see that they are still fiction. Everything they tell you is going to happen in the future, so it isn't a fact that they could document. Like the fictional world of Soylent Green, which was supposed to be 50 years into the future, the pseudo-documentaries are also creating a vision of the future, where somebody like George Lucas uses images and dialogue to create a whole other world for Star Wars. The climate fearmonger movies do the exact same thing. They create a whole other world where everything has gone wrong. They use images, usually of disasters. Nobody uses images of people sunning on a beach to say, ooh, climate change. Anyway, they use images to create in your mind a scary image of a very bad world. Lucas did it to entertain us. The hucksters do it to frighten and cajole us. A takeaway from this episode might be to keep a skeptical eye on the EnviroDoom stories that we're being told. Don't fall into believing that the scary world that they've cooked up will be the world that we'll live in 7 years from now, or whatever the deadline is they cite. They keep being very wrong, but they still keep predicting doom. Ah, but that's enough about them. Let's talk about you. If you have any comments on the content of these doom chats, feel free to send me an email, mick@mick-roland.com. Up next week should be Chapter 8 of Book 6, The Summer of Wood and Iron. Thanks for listening.